From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. And Georgia enters a new era today after its shelter-in-place order expired at midnight last night. But the state's governor, Brian Kemp, says people over 65 and those with health problems should continue to stay home until June 12th.
And Tanya, the state of Georgia is already reporting today that 1,000 new cases of coronavirus have been reported in the last 24 hours. So we'll continue to watch that situation. Meanwhile, Connecticut ranks third in deaths per capita from coronavirus after New York and New Jersey. And three Connecticut metro areas are among the worst hit in the country when it comes to the death toll. Those would be Bridgeport, Hartford, and New Haven. We're joined now by the mayor of New Haven, Connecticut, Mayor Justin Elicker. Thanks for being here.
I'm happy to be on.
And we should say that infection rates in your city are just beginning to level off. But when you hear about those numbers compared to the rest of the country, is it simply proximity to New York that is leading to so much death from COVID-19 in Connecticut, or is it something more?
We think it's mostly proximity to New York. And, of course, places like New Haven, we're at the end of the Metro North line and have a strong connection with this city. And we've seen the cases slowly spread and increase from New York to Fairfield County and to New Haven. We have been fortunate. We had some more warning of how things could be, seeing what happened in New York. And so we started to very proactively promote social distancing and protect the community and prepare well in advance.
Well, you say proactively. Your governor asked residents to work from home on March 12th, but he didn't order businesses to close until more than 10 days later on March the 23rd. Do you think that was too slow looking back?
I think that, you know, in New Haven, I closed schools quite early, and we halved the occupancy rate of a lot of businesses. And I think that the governor was quite proactive in general. Of course, in hindsight, there's always things that we could have been doing differently. But when you think about just how much the New Haven community has worked really hard to prepare for this, the fact that our hospitals haven't been totally overrun and have managed the capacity is a testament to the fact that I think we were pretty proactive about things.
And do you think the worst is over in New Haven?
As long as we stay the course, as long as we don't open up too quickly, as long as our residents continue to do what they've been doing, which is wearing masks and practicing social distancing, generally being cautious about going out, my hope is that we're over the worst for this period.
Well, so on that note, Governor Ned Lamont announced a 4-stage plan to reopen the state starting May 20th. That includes the opening of offices, retail stores, hair and nail salons, outdoor areas at restaurants, and outdoor museums and zoos. Do you think that's the right timeline?
I think that the details are what's important, and how we do this is what's important. And we've been having a lot of conversations in New Haven about how we can support businesses slowly opening but doing so safely. And that's everything from talking with businesses about installing a takeout window or plexiglass to protect their employees, to increasing access to hand sanitizer, to making sure that they have a plan to keep their workers safe inside. I think as long as we work together to support our businesses, public confidence is actually a pretty key component to all this as well. You know, businesses have opened in other states, and because the public is concerned, there hasn't been as much business. So I think we need to do that hand in hand. So we got to do it slowly but carefully.
Can you do that in the next 19 days before May 20th?
Again, it depends on how it's done. I think that if we do it slowly, and we also have a few weeks left before that date, so I think that it's important that we monitor the virus, the new cases, to confirm that we are continuing on that downward trend. I think that it would be much more detrimental to the economy if we did start to open up and then there were more outbreaks and we had to close up for a much longer period.
Are you worried that you're going to start to see the kind of protests that we're seeing now in the state of Michigan, people who really just want the economy open back up now?
You know, we had a small protest at the Capitol about a week ago. In general, New Haven residents have been very supportive of working as a community to tackle this thing. My concern is that some of the opening up dialogue has been too political. Two Republicans say this, Democrats say that, and that's not productive. We need to be listening to the epidemiologists and the experts here and working together. And my sense is New Haven residents, by and large, are on board with that.
Mayor, you've said that schools won't reopen until the fall. Are you also preparing for the possibility that they won't open in the fall, or that they will open and will then have to close again because of another spike in cases?
You know, this thing has changed so quickly every day that it's hard for me to speculate what things are going to be like in a few months. I would anticipate that as we all start to get used to our new lifestyle, that we'll think very carefully about putting in safety measures to allow schools to open, but maybe not in the same way that we typically have schools open. And I think that's very much the same for businesses. You know, in New Haven, for example, we're talking about, and the governor's talking about outdoor only in the beginning. So I think that we're going to see a lot of changes in the way we do things, but we've got to keep life moving.
That is the mayor of New Haven, Connecticut, Justin Ellicker. Mayor, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, President Trump told governors this week to seriously consider resuming the school year. The nation's two biggest unions shot back, saying they would consider protests or strikes if schools reopen too soon. The American Federation of Teachers have now put together its own plan for when schools should reopen. And for more, we're joined on Skype with Randy Weingarten. She's the president of the AFT. And Randy, the CDC has drafted guidelines on when schools should start to reopen. And one suggestion is to keep class groups together throughout the day so they're not mixing with students. Tell us more about your plan.
Yep. We think about a plan to reopen schools and other workplaces rests on five pillars, two of which are really public health tools that others have to do, like governors, like the president, two of which are things school people have to do, or, you know, other, you know, and parents. And one is the money that we need to get. So these are the five things. First, maintaining physical distancing in the community until the number of new cases declines for at least 14 consecutive days. Number two, putting in place what we've heard so many people talk about, the infrastructure and the resources to test, trace, and isolate new cases. Number three, deploying the public health tools that prevent the virus's spread and aligning them with the education strategies that meet the needs of students. That's why the staggering, the isolation rooms, the screening coming in, maybe wearing masks, hand washing every hour on the hour, all of these have to be worked in. Four, you gotta involve workers, unions, parents, communities in this planning because they know more and they won't trust it if they're not involved. And number five, you can tell from what I'm saying that this is gonna actually cost more money, not less money. You know, I heard Mitch McConnell say today, well, I don't want to forfeit other generations. Well, if you don't want to forfeit America's future, then you have to actually spend the money now to make sure that kids have a decent year next year, particularly in the absence of a vaccine, because we have to be able to assure parents and educators that their safety is paramount.
You talked about a vaccine. It's not in your list of five, but what do you think about this idea? Should schools stay closed until there actually is a vaccine?
I don't think we can stay closed until there is a vaccine. I mean, we know that there's not going to be the assurance of full safety until there is. But look, you know, chickenpox, it took years to get a vaccine. Polio, tuberculosis, and ultimately, as we have said for years and years and years, you know, remote learning, it's a supplement. It can't supplant regular instruction. And now you see, because of this experiment, which frankly, teachers had to turn on a dime to do, school districts all across the country in 3 or 4 days put together grab-and-go programs to feed 30 million kids, put together remote instruction. This is not the way to run anything.
Yeah. Randy, do you worry about the long-term effect for students who haven't been in the classroom for months? I mean, I do.
Yes. I'm born to be a worrier. So I worry about a lot of things. I worry about the anxiety. I worry about the loss of relationship building. But if we can create an environment, either through some voluntary summer programs where we try some stuff, or an environment in September where we can really community build in school and assess where kids are, youth think about next year for the non-graduating seniors as a real year of transition and bridging. Then, just like, you know, in the aftermath of World War II, people in the country became stronger, and it became an experience that redefined us. And that is what I am hoping. And government needs to buffer against all of the short-term and long-term education and economic issues.
That's Randy Weingarten, president of the American Federation of Teachers. Randy, thank you so much.
You're welcome, Tanya. Thank you.
This week, several airlines implemented guidelines requiring all passengers and crew members wear masks to prevent the spread of the coronavirus. But recent images of crowded flights shared on social media have raised concern for flight attendants that not enough is being done to ensure their safety. Sarah Nelson is the union president of the Association of Flight Attendants, and she recently wrote a letter to federal officials urging them to limit travel. Welcome, Sarah.
Thank you so much.
Earlier this week, you shared an image of a crowded flight on Twitter. Can you tell us more about that picture and where it was taken?
I have been getting reports from flight attendants over the past week that they've been experiencing full flights. And this is a result of the planes being taken out of the air. So there's fewer planes taking off now. With all the discussion about opening states back up, there's been a slight increase in the number of people getting onto planes. So this particular picture was actually sent to me by Sean Penn, who was moving people around for his Core Response charity that has set up testing sites all over. The actor Sean Penn, and he's helped to set up testing sites all over California. And he actually pulled his essential workers off that plane and rebooked them on charter flights to get them around, but was very concerned about this and contacted a member of Congress who told him that he should get in touch with me.
Mm. You lead a union that represents 50,000 flight attendants across 20 airlines, and we've been hearing about some of the measures companies have taken requiring passengers to wear masks and those types of things. Your union sent a letter to the Transportation Secretary and the Health and Human Services Secretary. What are you asking for?
One of the things that we're asking for in that letter is a requirement by the government for anyone in aviation stepping up to the airport door or on the airplane be wearing a face covering or mask. As we know, supply chain issues have made it difficult to have the proper protective gear. And so recognizing that we don't have a supply chain to have the proper equipment for flight attendants on board, we're saying that the government needs to step in and say that everyone has to have a face covering. So this was key to our letter, and that the department is moving forward with what was contemplated under the CARES Act to ensure that essential service to all of our communities continues. But during this time, we don't have any extra travel that is unnecessary now, and we're not aiding in the spread of the coronavirus through aviation.
Oh, okay. So in that same letter, when you say this extra travel, you are also asking for leisure travel to stop for the time being. What do you mean by that? Is that what you mean by extra travel?
What we mean by that is that there is absolutely a necessity for people to be traveling right now. First and foremost, we have our first responders or essential workers who are going to hotspots to help. The best way that we could describe cutting back on the travel is to say no leisure travel. But really what is contemplated in the CARES Act is ensuring that essential travel is continuing at this time, but recognizing the advice from healthcare professionals that the rest of us stay home. If we don't have business out to support our communities or support the professionals who are trying to contain the virus. So saying no leisure travel was another way of saying that.
Yeah. You know, most of us have been on a plane. We know what a plane is like. I think even during normal times, we're thinking about the flu season, colds, recycled air. I mean, there are so many unknowns that we don't know about this coronavirus. Are you concerned about that larger issue, that we can have all of these safety measures in place, but a plane might not be as foolproof and safe because we don't really know what places are safe.
We've been learning a lot about the coronavirus since it first arrived on the scene here. And so there is a possibility of using this time to make aviation safe, but also to use this time to put policies in place so that at some point here, even before we have a vaccine, we can return to some level of normalcy. We count on the traveling public knowing that when you buy a plane ticket, you're going to be safe. And that's what we are asking that we set up so that we can get to a space where people can confidently buy tickets again.
That's Sarah Nelson. She's the union president of the Association of Flight Attendants. Sarah, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, now for some music. Oscar-winning composer Randy Newman is known for his Toy Story songs and scores for films like Marriage Story. Now he's turned his talents to writing a song about social distancing.
Stay away from me. Baby, keep your distance, please. Stay away from me. Words of love in times like these.
That's called Stay Away, and the song's proceeds will benefit the Ellis Marsalis Center in New Orleans. And Randy Newman joins me now. Welcome.
It's good to be here, Jimmy. Thank you.
So the public radio station KPCC asked you to say some words about social distancing, and you decided, of course, to write a song about it.
Yeah, not of course exactly, but I had an idea for something. I mean, music and Stay Away came into my head, which isn't much of an idea, but that was it. So I wrote a song, and it turned out all right. So I decided to give that to them.
Well, and it's called Stay Away, but it also sounds like a love song to your wife. The first line refers to Venus in sweatpants.
Yeah.
How are the two of you handling being together all the time?
We're getting along well, you know, as well as could be expected. I mean, even, no, any qualification would be wrong. We are getting along fine, but... You just have the little things that might bother you, you let go. And some big things, really. I mean, like, for instance, I've noticed I can't get her to watch something with me. And if someone else tells her about a show, she's locked into it and she'll watch it. If I tell her about something, it's like maybe it'll sort of fall on her by mistake and she'll look at it. But it's just, it's difficult. And since that's what we're doing a good portion of the time, it's like watching the same show in different rooms. Hey, that was funny, wasn't it? You know, it's very odd.
Now, do you feel any difference right now in your mood or creativity? I mean, you obviously were able to write a song here, but what how are you feeling creatively?
Yeah. Not bad. I have an idea for another one. It's about Trump. I don't know whether I'll do it, but I'll see if I can get a song out of it. It's a little lumpy now. Seems like as I get older, things come a little harder in some ways. I get less of those gifts that you sometimes get writing where, you know, when you're writing in school and they give you a test, essay test, and you're just occasionally rambling along, you know, heretofore, nevertheless, everything's coming. And I get less of those gifts as I get older.
You've gotten 22 Oscar nominations.
Yeah.
For film scores and songs. Right now, of course, coronavirus has pretty much shut down film production. Are you still working on film music right now?
No, I'm not. I'm always studying a bit, you know, orchestration, reading scores and stuff, but I'm not working on anything.
What do you think's going to happen to Hollywood because of this?
I think Hollywood will be all right. I don't know how long people are going to stay out of theaters, but there's always, you know, there's going to be streaming and things like that. I mean, at the height of the Depression, the movie business was doing fine. It'd be one of the last industries to really get destroyed by this thing, I think. My wife has Dodger tickets, and I don't know how they're going to handle whether they're going to give money back to her or us, I guess, or what.
I can't believe they make you even pay for Dodger tickets, given that don't they play your song in every game?
Yeah, they do.
I Love L.A.
They do. Well, I gave that to them.
So when's the Trump song going to come out?
I don't know. I can't stand him, and I've never written something that was impelled by hate the way this one is, and I just don't want that to stick out too much.
Can we have a taste of it?
Let me think. Let's see. It starts out, the orange man's coming. Boom, boom, boom. The orange man's coming. The orange man coming, going to chase your blues away. Junk like that. I say, the orange man's running. Let's see. Hold on just a second. The orange man's coming. The orange man's coming. The orange man's coming. The orange man's coming, gonna chase your blues away. The orange man's running. The orange man running. There's junk in the company. The orange man's running for the presidency of the USA. And he won. Me one. Says the ghost of George Washington. And then it continues with Washington saying, I was there at the beginning, but I think the end has just begun. That ain't bad. And then he says, don't they know that he's crazy? Don't they know that he's mean? Don't they know he's the most conceited man this world has ever seen? Then the lumps begin to occur.
Well, Randy Newman, whatever you're singing about, it's an honor to have you here on the show and to hear that song first before anybody else. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And you can see the video of Stay Away at hereandnow.org.
I love LA.
Michigan's Governor Gretchen Whitmer is not backing down. After more protests at the Capitol building in Lansing yesterday, there were some protesters heavily armed there. Governor Whitmer has extended Michigan's state of emergency declaration through May 28th. Republicans say Whitmer's use of executive order to extend the date is an abuse of power and are reportedly threatening to sue her. For more, let's bring in Abigail Sensky, who's a reporter with WKAR in East Lansing, who was at the protest yesterday. Abigail, let's first talk about the protest itself, because there are photos circulating of very heavily armed protesters shouting at Capitol Police. Describe the scene you saw yesterday.
So those militia members were there to provide what organizers called additional security, although there was a high presence of Michigan State Police that were also there. There were more people gathered on the Capitol lawn yesterday than there were a few weeks ago when thousands of people drove to Lansing. State police estimate between 400 and 700 people showed up on the lawn yesterday, about a third of them social distancing and wearing masks. There were a collection of different groups there, anti-abortion rights protesters, religious protesters, and people waving Trump 2020 flags and Don't Tread on Me flags. And they were there to protest because they say the stay-at-home order is unconstitutional. And later, when the protest moved inside, they chanted "Our house" and let us in outside of the House of Representatives chamber. And some armed protesters made their way into the Senate gallery.
Do you have a sense of who's organizing these protests?
Yeah, so the group Michigan United for Liberty was the group that organized this on Facebook. They're classified as a nonprofit. They've actually sued the governor. And their event was actually taken down several times because it technically violates Facebook's policy that's, you know, as encouraging people to violate social distancing. So there were kind of a collection of groups that sprung up to repost the event. So the main group was Michigan United for Liberty.
Meanwhile, the coronavirus has killed nearly 4,000 people in Michigan, making it the state with the third most deaths after New York and New Jersey. What did people there say about that?
So everyone I talked to generally agreed that the coronavirus is real, but some of them thought the deaths from COVID-19, especially here in Michigan, were being inflated and overreported. Other people I talked to said that they didn't believe that the virus was, quote, floating around at the protest. But, you know, some other protesters I talked to agreed that the governor's first orders were necessary to flatten the curve and protect our hospitals and healthcare workers. But now they would like to see the governor getting approval from the state legislature, which is dominated by Republicans, to further extend the emergency declaration here.
And just a few seconds here, but what happens next?
So the governor has issued an emergency declaration through the 28th, and Republicans in the state legislature are gearing up for a legal challenge. So this could turn into a court battle.
That is Abigail Senske, who is covering what's happening in Michigan for WKAR in East Lansing. Abigail, thank you.
Of course.
And interesting to hear there that people think that the number of deaths is overreported. A lot of the data suggests that it could be underreported.
And caregivers of children, how are you guys doing out there? Last month, Education Week asked parents and kids to interview each other about what it's like to spend 24 hours a day together.
How are you feeling today, Mom?
Feeling a little stressed out. Things are kind of crazy, and I'm trying to keep a schedule, but you guys don't really make it that easy.
Definitely overwhelming a little bit. There's a lot more energy in the house, a lot more mess in the house, and a lot more demands on Mommy's time.
What's happening with the economy and the lack of a steady paycheck kind of makes me feel a little bit anxious.
So many of us are balancing work, home life, and online school with the kids. And for a lot of us, all of this is happening at the same time. Well, Shauna Lee, an associate professor at the University of Michigan School of Social Work, has been studying what so many of us are dealing with, and she joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you.
So your research found something that is likely not surprising to many folks out there. 52% of parents say financial stress is interfering with their parenting. Tell us more about that.
Yes, we did a survey of American parents about how they were adapting to the pandemic right after schools closed, about 2 weeks after the World Health Organization declared the pandemic, and asked parents about what was happening in their household. As you said, over half of parents were concerned about bills and worried that money would run out and that those financial concerns and social isolation were getting in the way of their parenting. Mm-hmm. Parents said that they were spending more time with their kids and felt actually closer and warmer to them than normal. Mm. But at the same time, parents also said that they were using discipline more frequently. 25% of parents said they were having more conflicts in the past 2 weeks.
Yes. So let's talk a little bit about that conflict. So your study also reveals that about a quarter of parents said they have screamed, yelled, or shouted at their kids more often. About 5% in your research are actually spanking more often. This is really difficult because parents are stressed. Kids are stressed. You're a parent. You have a one-year-old and a seven-year-old. What are some suggestions that you have in navigating this?
Right. No doubt it's a very difficult time. Well, some suggestions that it can be useful for kids of all ages is taking the time to give them attention, which is, of course, easier said than done since we're all, many of us at least, are trying to also work from home. So making some time and space to give children concentrated attention, even in small doses of 5 to 10 minutes throughout the day, can help them kind of recalibrate. You know, it won't work necessarily so well with very young children, like 1, 2, and 3-year-olds who just can't really keep themselves entertained. But older children really benefit from knowing that you're there, even if you're engaged in other activities and your attention is not fully on them at that moment. I think it's important to recognize and validate how this has disrupted their life and how stressful it might be for them to be apart from their friends, missing school, and having such major disruptions to their routines.
Yeah, you know, which makes me think about maybe some of the behavioral changes that we should be looking out for and how parents can really effectively address them, those behavioral changes that you're seeing in your children who are exhibiting stress.
Absolutely. I think you would expect to see, in some ways, behaviors that adults might have as well. Fearfulness, trouble sleeping, small children might feel clingy, excessively sad, or even acting out behaviors for some children. So maybe more temper tantrums or a little bit of hyperactivity, trouble focusing. Mm-hmm. Those types of behaviors are quite common in children. And if they persist for a long period of time or seem abnormally high, it might mean that your child's having a hard time managing their feelings during this pandemic.
Yeah. You have a prediction that once school is back in session, educators will need to have systems in place to address the social-emotional backsliding as well as academic. Can you explain?
Yes, I think that most families are going to adapt to this enormously stressful time, and most kids are probably going to be okay in the long run. But a lot of kids are experiencing major disruptions. Their parents have experienced job loss. They may not have enough money to buy food. Interpersonal violence seems to be on the rise, and many experts are concerned also about child maltreatment, child abuse and neglect increasing. So when kids get back to school, my hope is that school professionals will be able to provide trauma-informed services and care to kids in school to help kids who have been traumatized by this event address their feelings and hopefully improve their functioning in the school setting. There's some really great evidence-based models for trauma-informed care in school settings.
Yeah. You know, this pandemic is really revealing just how much our culture and society is not structured for families to be around each other all of this time, and managing home life and work being more nimble to being at home. Do you think that this crisis will change our attitudes about parenting and structured support for working families?
I really hope so. I hope that the pandemic is the beginning of a national conversation about how to support working families and creating more flexible workplaces, family leave policies for all workers when kids and family members are sick, better support for childcare, universal access to childcare, and maybe even the kind of income supports that will benefit low-income parents, like a universal basic income for children. So we know low-income parents are struggling, especially during this pandemic, and are likely to be affected disproportionately. And those kids are really getting left behind by our social safety net. So my hope is that this is an opportunity to have that conversation and hopefully put better practices into place for working families and their children.
That's Shauna Lee. She's an associate professor at the University of Michigan School of Social Work. And we'll link you to her study on stress and parenting and her tips on navigating all of this during this coronavirus pandemic at hereandnow.org. Thank you so much, Shauna, for joining us.
Thank you.
And if you're caring for children right now, we'd like to hear about your experience. Share your thoughts with us at hereandnow.org. With many schools closed now for the foreseeable future, one young student from Austin, Texas, found a unique way to learn more about the coronavirus that has forced him and millions of other kids to do their schoolwork from home.
My name is Umar Muhammad, and I'm in seventh grade. I'm 12 years old. So, I was studying the coronavirus genome, and I came across this concept called DNA music, which basically means, like, you take a DNA sequence and you turn it into music. So I thought, why not make some music out of the coronavirus genome? The coronavirus genome, it's made of four letters, also called nucleotides. So the four nucleotides are A, U, G, and C. And to make music out of them, each nucleotide in the genome, or each letter in the genome, you could say, I turned each one into a specific note. Now that I'm not in school, my teacher assigned me a project that we called the Passion Project, and in that, we basically research whatever we want. So I have always had like a really big passion in genetics. Well, I thought, like, why not squeeze some extra time into research? Like, the thing that's going on right now, the reason that we're out of school right now is because of the coronavirus, so why not research it? One interesting thing that I learned about the coronavirus was that Its proteins are so specialized to create like the most havoc in the human body as possible. Like, for example, there's one protein called the envelope protein. It is specifically designed to like cause inflammation in the human body. And there's like other proteins which trick the human body into thinking that the virus isn't a threat. And it's just very interesting, like how all these systems work together in the virus. Like, it's such a tiny thing, but it's like almost like tailor-made to cause havoc. It's not like your typical music that you hear. It's not exactly enjoyable, it's just interesting to me that it creates rhythms. Like, it almost seems like a random mix of letters, like the genome. It almost seems like a random combination of letters. Once you turn them into music, they actually like sound just slightly pleasing. But I wouldn't expect to hear this at a party. Like, there's obviously much better music that would be played there, but still, I find it more interesting than melodious.
Omar Mohammed is from Austin, Texas, and his story was produced by Joy Diaz from member station KUT.
Netflix came out with a new high school series this week. It's called Never Have I Ever, and it's the brainchild of actor and writer Mindy Kaling. The show opens with its main character praying at her family's Hindu shrine.
Hey, gods, it's Devi Vishwakumar, your favorite Hindu girl in the San Fernando Valley. What's poppin'?
Well, NPR TV critic Eric Deggans joins us now to talk about it. Hi, Eric.
Hey.
So there have been a million shows about high school, but this one is centered on an Indian American girl, which is unique.
Yeah. You know, what I love about this show is that it does tell you some of the typical stories that you might expect from a coming of age drama. She's struggling with the loss of a parent. She has another parent who's much more traditional than she is, and she's trying to balance being a modern girl who can hang out with her friends, but also living up to what her mother expects from her. And she wants to have a boy in her life. In fact, she wants to lose her virginity. So there's a lot of themes there that we've seen in other shows, but it's very different because they're seen through the lens of this very specific character. And she's got this little crew of people with her who are also pretty cool. She's got an Asian girl who's her friend, who's the head of the drama club. And she's got what seems like a biracial friend. I think she's biracial. She might just be African-American. And the three of them are kind of like this trio charging through the school. And we've even got a clip of them talking about each other. Let's check it out.
This year, we're rebranding.
We are glamorous women of color who deserve a sexy high school life.
Fabiola, you are naturally snatched, but you dress like a helpful Honda guy.
What are you talking about? The janitor said I reminded him of his nephew. Favorite nephew.
Eleanor, could you chill out on your spontaneous show tune singing?
Not likely.
Well, if you refuse to change your personalities, I guess we'll just move on to step two and get boyfriends.
Boyfriends?
So you can hear the flavor of their relationship there already. And so as they progress through all of these different changes that each of them is going through, but particularly the lead character, it's just a different way of telling a coming-of-age story.
We should also mention that tennis legend John McEnroe narrates the show. Here he is after an upsetting moment in the first episode.
When you're a normal person with genuinely balanced reactions to things, it may be hard to understand why we hotheads fly off the handle. For me, it's a reasonable reaction to the general blindness of most tennis umpires. For Davey, it's a logical response to being betrayed by her supposed best friends. How could Eleanor have a boyfriend and not tell her about it?
So when I hear that, I wonder, is this like Arrested Development with a narrator? Or what do you think of the choice of narrator there?
Well, I think it's interesting. I mean, they explain later in the first episode, the reason she hears John McEnroe's voice is because he was her dad's favorite tennis player. And her dad, we see, dies of a heart attack out of nowhere at a school function. You know, part of this is her acting out in school because she has this grief she's not dealing with. And one way she's processing it is having the voice of John McEnroe pop up in her head every so often. But it also kind of highlights the absurdist humor of the actual show. I will say, you know, this is Netflix. And one of the things I noticed about Netflix's shows about teens is that the way they distinguish them is that they do have a lot of sex in them. Mm. From the very first episode, this character picks the most popular boy in school, and she decides she wants to lose her virginity to him. Not date him or have him be her boyfriend or kiss him. She wants to have sex with him. You know, I'll be honest, it makes it a little uncomfortable for me when I'm watching this show with my 15-year-old. So so people should know that kind of going into this, even though, you know, I think it's a great show and I really enjoyed it.
Okay, well, Eric, as this show comes onto the scene, we should note that several shows have just wrapped up, including Will and Grace, Empire, and Homeland, all airing their final episodes recently. I just watched the last episode of Homeland. What are we going to watch now, Eric? Or what do you think about all these shows ending right now?
Well, it's interesting because Empire, for example, ended a sort of a historic run. And it had to end it early because the lockdown forced them to stop production before they had fully filmed their final episode. You know, we saw Will and Grace, it ended and then it came back after some time. And mm-hmm. now it's ending again and it seems to be ending for good this time. And in both of those shows, Empire and Will and Grace, you know, those were groundbreaking shows that didn't seem all that groundbreaking when they aired their final episodes. Like, the TV world and society had kind of caught up with them. Whereas with Homeland, we had a show that I think remained kind of interesting and a little ahead of the curve right up until its final episode. But also, this was a show that ultimately went from being a cautionary tale about how America freaked out in the wake of 9/11 to being this sort of tribute to the heroism of CIA intelligence officers. And that's an interesting message to drop at a time when the president has been openly contemptuous of, you know, intelligence operations and the intelligence establishment.
Well, I, for one, Eric, am going to miss Homeland, but I am glad to know that we are still living in the golden age of television. NPR TV critic Eric Deggans, thanks so much as always.
Always a pleasure.
And by the way, we are listening here to the theme song for the FX show Mrs. America, which I am currently watching on Hulu now that Homeland is over. It's about the movement to ratify the Equal Rights Amendment. And so far, so good. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now.